Yeah, Dhamma friends, this is the time we allocated for a Dhamma talk, or today's Dhamma talk. We are going to have going to start the series with this particular Dhamma talk. So, as a consent, you may, to start the Dhamma talk, give consent with 3 times, sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Namo tasse bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhasse. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhasse. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammā sambuddhasse. Nanu maya moga purisaṁ aneka pariyāyena paticca samuppannaṁ viññānaṁ buddhaṁ anyatra paccaya natti viññānassa sambhavo tīti. Dear Dhamma friends, whenever we are going to have a retreat like this, we'll say a residential retreat, in order to facilitate the meditation, we have to give different kinds of facilities. According to the teaching of the Buddha, whenever someone is aiming towards the purification of the mind, he or she must be facilitated with 5 aspects. The very first thing is, he or she must be ready to accept or undergo this moral training, sila sikha. So, one has to take care about that, and purification and observance towards the moral training. The second aspect is, you must listen to the teaching of the Buddha, that is to get a certain amount of theory understanding, book knowledge, while you are practicing, while you are keep on advancing. The third aspect the Buddha enumerated is, that you must have time to time discussions in order to have a rapport with other fellow practitioners, if possible with advanced practitioners, so that you can rectify your own doubts, questions. So therefore discussions also a kind of a must. The fourth aspect is, you have to take time yourself, sit and meditate in order to develop certain amount of one-pointedness, concentration. The fifth and the last was, you have to practice wisdom training, that is to, through this concentrated mind, one must penetrate into, scrutinize into, see things as they are. So likewise, there are 5 facilities you have to take care about. So delivering a talk, as listening to a talk, sometimes reading a good book. Therefore, it's a must, it's an essential thing for someone to practice, otherwise get stuck with. So that is why we have allocated time separately for a talk like this. And for this particular retreat, we are in Orlando, we have taken one particular discourse delivered by the Buddha as the main topic. As far as the teaching of the Buddha is concerned, it is, according to the contemporary time, present time, divided into 3 aspects, 3 baskets. First and foremost is his direct discourses, that is to say, events and incidents took place during his contemporary time. Meeting a person, and happening an event, sometimes Buddha himself, out of his initiative, he give, deliver a talk or have a discourse. They are called Sutta Pitaka or discourses. Or sometimes in a narrow sense we call Dhamma. The other part is the Vinaya, that is to the monastic code or disciplinary rules the Buddha enumerated. For full-time meditators, maybe monks or nuns or lay people, male or female. So they should abide by the this monastic code. So this is also voluminous thing. So that is also part and partial, came directly out of his teaching. The third one is presently recognized as Abhidhamma. That is some psychological analysis. And many Westerners, I'm critical, even Sri Lankans, consider it is not directly from the Buddha, but later secondary data analysis. But whatever may be, there are a lot of references to the original discourses and to the monastic code. So they are kind of a tabulation and analysis of the teaching. So these are the three baskets, if you wish to be acquainted with the teaching of the Buddha. The particular Mahatanna Sankhya Sutta, I quoted from the basket of discourses, that is called Sutta, sometimes called Dhamma. So that particular part, that particular basket itself has divided into five. Dīgha Nikāya, Majjhima Nikāya, Saṅgata Nikāya, Anuttara Nikāya and Khuddaka Nikāya. The very first one, Dīgha Nikāya, is for a beginner, those who wish to develop moral restrainment. In the Dīgha Nikāya, long length sayings, detailed, long enumerations are there with respect to one's own moral conduct, or sometimes related relevance to the monastic code also. They are very detailed, so anyone happen to meet with the Buddha, have no any understanding about his discipline, about his teaching, so it happened Buddha to start from ABC. That is how these discourses became long one, and in the same same way it has been by-hearted and recorded, and that we call Dīgha Nikāya. And then come the middle length sayings. Those who are analyzing the Tipitaka in a broader sense, they say these middle length sayings are better basically for the meditators, those who are already little bit acquainted with, familiarized with, what does it mean by a lay practitioner? What does it mean by male and female lay practitioner? What does it mean by bhikkhu, that is male recluse and the nuns, and they are happy and already in the moral training? For them, concentration training and the wisdom training are prescribed basically in the middle length sayings. The particular sutta we have now taken as the topic is quoted from this middle length saying. It carries 152 discourses, this number 38 in the middle length. The others are Saṅgata Nikāya, very short events happen sometimes convincingly. The particular person become enlightened with the short discussion with the Buddha, and these things are come under Saṅgata Nikāya. So therefore those who are familiar with the Dīgha Nikāya and Majjhima Nikāya find bits and pieces here and there in the Saṅgata Nikāya. Sometimes with the later masters categorize them according to the subject matter, and it is carrying about more than 7,000 discourses. The balance is called Anguttara Nikāya, numerical order. There you can consult whenever Buddha giving a discourse with reference to one particular point, one particular aspect, then it is called as the Book of One. Whenever he is talking about two aspects, relevant to the two aspects, called Book of Two. And three aspects, four aspects, five aspects life enumerated according to the content. So that is called Anguttara Nikāya. And the last one is Khuddaka Nikāya, little particles. And sometimes the gist of the teaching you find in one sentence. That kind of a concentrated one you often find in the Khuddaka Nikāya. So there is a kind of a pattern, kind of a order when you are looking at the Sutta Pitaka from a broader sense. So therefore, if someone to be acquainted with all the Dīgha Nikāya, Majjhima Nikāya, Saṅgutta Nikāya, Anguttara Nikāya and Khuddaka Nikāya, it takes long time. But lucky enough, by now, all of them have been already translated fairly in authentic way to the English language. Thanks to the Pali Text Society, they started already, and it basically happened with respect to the Sri Lanka translation happened, and they were basically done by English lay people, and they happened them to learn the Pali language first and then translate according to their cultural upbringing, and therefore nowadays many are questioning and criticizing the original translation of the Pali Text Society. But anyway, it is a big contribution and a good starting point. But later, Venerable Jnanamoli and Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, both of them started editing, refining the same. Unlucky enough, Venerable Jnanamoli passed away maybe at his younger age. But Bhikkhu Bodhi is a contemporary monk from America, and he is living in New Jersey and New York, and he has completed very patiently all the books. So if you are happy to read, you can go to his middle and saying and get the reference from the, for this particular sutta, and many accept that day by day he is refining towards the good terminology. When and where he get the comprehensive understanding regarding the teaching of the Buddha, he himself edit his own writings, his own translation, and everyone present day, the whole world accept his translation as authentic, and therefore we are lucky now we can have direct access to the teaching of the Buddha. But later you may understand these translations are giving kind of a bridging for us to get the idea. But if you have your own Pali understanding, the original language of the Buddha, you feel more familiarized, you feel more homely, you feel more closer to the Buddha. But anyway, it is a kind of a big dedication, big sacrification as far as the academic aspects are concerned. So in the discourse, I will often get the translation of Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi, and I incorporate as much as possible the Pali terms so that if the translations are not up to the mark, I keep the space open for you to refer back to the Pali terms and get more further research and studies. So as far as this Mahatannasamkhya Sutta is concerned, it's basically about the analysis of the Buddha towards the consciousness. It happened as a result of an event whereby there was a monk called Sati. He used to profess, he used to promulgate a kind of a pernicious view, wrong view towards the consciousness. And he used to say, the consciousness is the very same consciousness passing from one life to the other, passing the same very consciousness, passing from the young age to the middle age to the old age. So therefore, there is a kind of a consistency. And in the sense, consciousness is permanent. Consciousness is eternal. So this is one view the Buddha categorically denied, telling it is one of the extremes. But this particular monk, contemporary of the Buddha, used to say that same consciousness transmigrating from life to life. So he was so adamant on that idea. So his colleagues and the fellow practitioners talk with him control, are you with this wrong view, pernicious view, as to say this same consciousness is transmigrating from life to life? He says yes. After this very confirmation, the bhikkhus or the other monks brought the issue to the Buddha and presented it as a petition. So then the Buddha asked particular monk, the Sati, to the congregation, and then the Buddha directly asked, are you with this wrong view, or conscious view, as to say that the same consciousness is transmigrating from life to life? Then he accepted yes. Then the Buddha is asking, where does I have mentioned this kind of thing? I try my best for you to I try my best to explain for you to tell this very consciousness is, it is not permanent, it is not an eternal thing, it is dependently arising and it is changing one to the other, and that is how it happens. So therefore, having said that so clearly, how can you making that kind of a wrong view? And then the Buddha is asking, in under this context, what do you mean by the consciousness? He gives his information. He says, when someone is talking, when someone is feeling something, and when someone is going to get the his or her consequences of the good and the bad action, the vijnana, the consciousness, is the one making them experience the consequences of the good and the bad karma or action, or vijnana, the consciousness, is the one helping talking, I mean in the communication, and that is the one give the feelings, the pleasure principle. So then the Buddha is negating it and mentioning him, this is something you must not promulgate, profess, or facilitate, because this is something built, something rejected. So as far as the teaching of the Buddha is concerned, right from the very first discourse, he often helped the practitioners to understand the two extremes. And not to fight with the two extremes, but by understanding the extremes and avoiding the two extremes, one has to assimilate the middle part. In that respect, it's often you can find reference in the canonical teaching. Some people, contemporary to the Buddha or previously or even now, they have a nihilistic or annihilation kind of a theory. They say after the death, everything finish. So therefore, whatever you do, whatever you talk, no consequences to the next life. Therefore, whatever the ways and means you are maximizing your pleasure is justified. Nothing to worry about the consequences. So that kind of views we call annihilation kind of thing. And these people, nihilistic kind of people, don't care about moral restraint. When and where the people going to take eternal kind of view, that means the other side, the same consciousness is going from life to life, so therefore whatever you do in this very life, you have to bear the cost in the next life. And whatever you talk, whatever you feel, is done by your consciousness, so you are responsible, you are getting committed. Whenever you talk, whenever you have any kind of a feeling, so therefore it is going to give an eternal theory. So recognizing and understanding and discreetly understanding, Buddha tries his best to not to go into these two extremes and help facilitate how to go into the middle path. The way the Sati, the Bhikkhu, presented this consciousness is more inclining towards the eternal theory. Eternalistic kind of a understanding or belief. So therefore, here the Buddha take time. It's a very low, very fairly long discourse. But they take time to deny or reject what the Bhikkhu Sati is going to say. So he takes the mean advantage of this event and try to prove or try to show the value of understanding this kind of a pernicious wrong view and to bring back the majority to the middle path. So in that sense, the outset, at the beginning, he says there is no such a transmigrating vijnana as such. He says consciousness is reckoned by the particular condition depending upon which it arises. So therefore, as far as the conditions are changing, the resultant consciousness also changing, so there is no continuity other than its reciprocal continuity. So this is the what we have to try and understand by these sermons and by this discourse. So that is what I thought of. Take time to explain as much as possible. So whenever we come up to this kind of analysis, we can see the mistake of the particular bhikkhu, Venerable Sati, that he has taken the consciousness as eternal, and therefore he says whenever you are talking, whenever you are feeling anything, that is coming, the root cause, proximate cause is the consciousness. And whatever you are going to do, due to the continuity of the consciousness, you are going to have the resultant advantages or disadvantages, consequences. That is how we define the consciousness. But in a way, he is rather philosophical. He is fairly advanced when compared to the other contemporary theories existed at that time. If I am to give a little analytical explanation, the Buddha himself recognized one being, specifically a human being, as five aggregates. He used to say, whenever a male or female, whatever may be a human being, that particular being has its own materiality, the corporeality, the body, it is the it's a matter, agglomeration and coming together of the materiality, that is to say, the earth element, the hardness, stiffness, tension, hardness, and then fire element, heat and cold, water element, cohesiveness and the fluidity, and air element, expansion, contraction and tension. So all these come into collapse into matter that makes agglomerate and make one unit we call a being, male or female. So therefore each and every one, a living being, has own body, own corporeality, the concrete measurable subject to the gravitational force, and some can touch and see. This is called rupa. Rupakhanda or agglomeration of materiality. So, present day, if you take this development, we call developed countries and non-developed third world countries, and measure the development by per capita income, gross national income, possession of a particular person, and whether it's rich or not, all these are coming under this corporeality, materiality, that is called materialistic view. This materialistic view is always with the nihilistic theory. They don't care, so anyone who is going to take this materialism, they don't care about the moral conduct. They are not responsible about the moral conduct. This is whatever the way you are going to earn, it the ends will justify the means, so therefore nothing to worry about the moral responsibilities, and therefore they are keep on maximizing their materialistic gain. And this materialistic gain itself, of course, going to give a kind of a satisfaction. The Buddha says in three ways. Of course, it has some parallelism with Sigmund Freud's presentation also. The well-developed theory of the Western philosophy. The first and foremost thing is when a person, when he or she come up to attend to the age, basically once sexually matured, he or she is always try to maximize the pleasure one gain through the eye by looking at different shapes and the colors, visual objects. So he try keep on accumulating, changing, tasting visual objects. That's the one part. Second thing is nice sounds, different musics and all the kind of sounds, and you are going to satisfy your ear, or to, so to say, eardrum. Or otherwise the smell, different kinds of smells, and the taste, your taste buds, your tongue, different kind of foods. And the fifth one is the comfort, luxurious furniture, vehicles, all the kind of thing. So we, from morning to evening, with overtime and everything, we try to maximize the visual objects, sounds, taste, smell, and the tactile things. And more and more you accumulate it, you are being called a rich person. And if you are lacking in up to your mark, we call a poor person, and he is not achieved. So therefore, this is one yardstick. We measure the development, advancement, richness, and this always this materialism is connected with nihilistic idea. They don't care the way they earn these things. And when and where you are happy with your eye, ear, nose, tongue and the body, you consider you achieve something. This is we call sensuous gratification. Sensuous gratification, each and every person. In this context, the Buddha enumerated it as a sensuous gratification, and exactly the same thing recognized by Sigmund Freud, he recognized as sexual gratification. But the parallelism you can see. The Buddha recognized it and put it as one part and partial of your gratification, that's a sensual gratification, and that is to say satisfying or fulfilling your organs, eye, ear, nose, tongue, and the body. And once you come up to that satisfaction, you often think about my beings and our beings, my relatives and my friends and my colleagues and our beings, our relatives and our colleagues. So you don't feel satisfied enough as far as your sensual gratification is finished. So then you feel like my and our. So then your scope start to become very big. The early part of the sensual gratification is called kama tanha, the materialistic gain. Second thing is called bhava tanha, that means not particular person, he or she think about my family and our family, our country, my religion, my creed, my denomination, and it spreads according to one's own definitions. And you can easily see, as far as you are trying to gratify your sensuous personal gratification, there is a scope, some possibility you can reach sometimes above average. But when and where you are going to give and share with my and our beings, it will become a very hard task. That is why so much of fighting and wars against religions, against countries, against creeds and kind of thing, more than one's own sensual gratification, when and where you are going to have this objective, difficulties are much, no one can reach, so therefore lot of impediments, lot of blockages, lot of friction happen. More and more friction happen, more and more failure happen, you develop antagonism, you develop irritation, you develop hatred. That is a shadow of the same desire. Desire to fulfill your, my and mine, our beings. And that is therefore ultimately it comes to the vibhava tanha. That is also a shadow of the same desire which is unfulfilled. Whenever you are thinking about my fellows and our fellows, and it has become a difficult task, when and where difficulty happens, anyone going to block, he or she become an enemy, and you are vehemently going to destroy and kill, and that is how the desire going to create kind of a hatred. So ultimately, you start with the desire, end up with the hatred, and up to the end of your life, you will keeping fighting. Ultimately, you will come to know you are just merely bounded with, limited with materiality. This materiality is going to give so much of, to keep the mind occupied throughout your life. 24 hours per day is not enough. 7 days per week is not enough. 365 days for the year is not enough. So much of it. And more you practice, it is simply, philosophically you can analyze and see, simply you have to lose your attention toward the morality. Somehow or the other you have to compromise. You have compromised somehow or the other to gratify it for you, and you and your beings, fellow beings, and sometimes your properties, and ultimately when and where it is going to be blocked and disturbed, you develop hatred. And you justify your hatred because you are developing this hatred due to good cause, good intention like. But ultimately what happens is, the picture become completely, the whole tapestry become complete, just by materiality. So that is what happened to America. And you people are very well known. Now, after 2012, even the whole world knows. That's the difference in 2012. 2012 is the leak happens. What is the jugglery they are playing to justify all the bad things they are doing. To keep one nation up, or one person up, or one philosophy is up, one religion is up. That is how it happens. So therefore, Sati, that particular bhikkhu is not caught up with that. Therefore, he is someone advanced, I am telling. He is not worrying about this gratification of visual objects or sounds or smell or taste or physical comfort. So therefore, the Buddha says many in the world are caught up simply with this materialism, and ultimately they are bound to lose their moral responsibilities. Ultimately, desperately, they are accumulating so much of neurosis, so much of frustration, so much of tension, and no answer. But this is not the only the root cause. Then there is another kind of people, they believe the feelings, pleasure principle. This is materiality, is not the matter. How much this material is going to give the pleasure. So they are very selective. They are very priority selecting. They say it's not only earning, we must maximize the pleasure. The pleasure principle is the one the scientific world assured by just pressing a button, you can get anything. So for the last 200 years, we were vehemently following the science, and it assured person with the technological development, with the infrastructure development, with the technological development, we can gain whatever we like, and therefore maximizing the pleasure or pleasure principle was widespread Of course, it depends somewhat upon the materialistic gain, but the pressure, the feeling is that the second thing happened. So there was a huge, I would say not a huge, a little fraction of the population, maybe about 10%, they used to control 90% of the wealth in the world, and they are maximizing the pleasure without any limitation. Ultimately, due to their fanatic decisions, political decisions, economical and social, the 90% of the balance population have to share only 10% of the wealth, and they are utterly desperate, nothing to eat, nowhere to live, no education, no health. They can't help because that people, those who are maximizing pleasure, are taking decisions for their benefit, and ultimately the human being became the main enemy to the human being. And this is, you can't attribute to this particular contemporary time. During the time of the Buddha also, exactly the same. This is called distribution of wealth. It is always unfair. If you study the Lorentz curve, it says very little fraction of people having so much of material. So much of material means so much of political power, economic power, social power, they interpret terms. And ultimately others have to surrender into that. That is the world. So therefore, whenever you go for the pleasure principle, according to the Buddha, no difference between human and the other beings, other beasts. That is what it happened. The survival of the fittest. And the powerful person will decide everything. This is what it happened. Even we call this a civilized world, cultured world, developed world, educated world. But this vicious nature, the chasing behind the pleasure, and ultimately how much you get engrossed with this principle, and how much you is obsessed with this principle, how much you go mad, very difficult, because after the deathbed, you will never look at this particular thing from a neutral point of view. So therefore, not only the materialism, but the feelings also, another aspect, leading people, not in the single person, humankind, completely blindfolded, bewildered. But this particular sati, the bhikkhu, is not on that track. Of course, he is wrong, but I am telling, he is not that trapped. Therefore, he is somewhat advanced. The third aspect is the perception. How do you perceive things? How do you define things? How do you cognize things and recognize things? Refighting is your own pet idea. Everyone thinks, my perception is the best, whole the world must accept it. If it is so, they are my friends. If someone is not going to accept my perception, they are my enemies. And he is the very person create the perception, he is the very person deciding and draw the inference. So therefore it is also kind of a misleading aspect of each and every individual. This perception ultimately sends people mad. That is why some people go for mystics, some people go for scientific, and some people decide about others, some people think it is a crime. So this is how the perception is going to play. So therefore, not a single being, those who can't see things as they are, can understand how much the perception is going to make agenda. And the worst thing is, this agenda is not for the well-being of the human being or that particular person. But this sati bhikkhu, the theory, the issue we have taken, is not obsessed with that. The fourth aspect is your fabrications, your creations, your productivity, your new innovations make yourself completely overwhelmed, and you say that you are so happy to introduce and boast about so-called your inner productivity, your innovation, your fabrication, your determination, your achievement. So that is what, just like a donkey chasing behind a carrot, we are in research. Keep on investing time for research, and ultimately you shift from the present moment, your whole aspiration and determination is in future. You never live in the present moment, you live in the future, because you are the future expectation going to give so much of excitement. And you see it is doping yourself, so therefore it is called sankhara, or manipulation, manifestations, creation, fabrications, productivity, all kind of things keep ourselves busy. Early morning, we have so much of plan, and throughout the day, up to the point of exhaustion, you try, and you know it is not a fulfilled day or a successful day, but come and sleep, and tomorrow morning you start with another list of things to do. This is what we teach for the youngsters. This is what the religious masters teach their followers, and therefore we have always ambitions, and that is also one thing to keep, one thing possessed or obsessed. So this is called sankhara. So in India, during the time of the Buddha, they thought if you are to accept any kind of a soul or the core or essence of your life, there were some people so materialistic. They told some or the other, you have to maximize the pleasure. But many rejected that, telling materialism is very nihilistic. So therefore, they are not abiding by the rules and regulation, ethics, and moral responsibility. So they rejected. But they people were maximizing all the sensuous gratification. And there were some people chasing behind pleasure. Kings and Maharajas and all the kind of. There were some people based upon their perception, and they thought depending and spending the whole life of materialism is lowly, it is no good, and depending the whole life of the pressure principle is also no good. But someone has a kind of understanding about the perception, it is much, much, much refined life. But yet another kind they were, they told, we are much refined because we are not worrying about the materialism. We are not worrying much about the sensual gratification. We are not much worrying about this perception. We are creating. We are producing, research, doing research and all the kind of thing. And gradually they were claiming we are better than other people. Each and everyone negated, but the last one to be challenged was the consciousness. Everyone thought, with compared to consciousness, materiality is lowly. Pressure principle is lowly. Perception is lowly. Creativity and adjusting and fabrications are lowly. But the consciousness is the core aspect. So when the Buddha emerged to the world, in a equal way, he has to understand these five other things we call a being. All of them, materiality, the feeling, the perception, the mental formations and the consciousness, all nothing but a dream. So sati was a trap in the last link, where the consciousness is the matter, it is going life to life. Others are changing, others can be forego, but consciousness we can't forego, we have to take responsibility. Consciousness is me, myself, my soul. So this is the point Buddha got the grip, and he wanted to rectify this mistake in the sati, and not only for himself, he take the congregation of the monks and start delivering a discourse how to get rid of this wrong view. So therefore, first and foremost, he bring the sati to the congregation, to the meeting, and tell, where does I indicate anywhere in my teaching to say this consciousness is eternal? And the Buddha says, you are misrepresenting me. and you are undermining yourself, and you are going to get a very bad consequences. So therefore, it is better to take it up and discuss and rectify. That is how the discourse is progressing further. So therefore, it's a long, through a long discourse, long rapport, discussion, Buddha is slowly, try to see the disadvantage of this kind of acceptance. And even though it is difficult, if you can see through it, if you can see its transient nature, how much benefit you can get. But as I mentioned, this Mahatanna Sankhya Sutta is basically related to the consciousness. We have to get a lot of experience and comparison with respect to the materiality. We have to get a comparative analysis, understanding with respect to the feelings, with respect to the perception, with respect to the mental formation. Then only we can figure it out, we can work it out, the same nature in the consciousness also. But otherwise, each and every one of us with this wrong notion, whether we accept it or not, that is why we call my identity, my name, my this and that. And we think that it is my duty to maximize this I, myself, and myself, my soul. So, but we, some of us may be ready and happy to understand materialism is not the final core, final thing to achieve, and it has its own disadvantage. Some of us, we may ready to accept that the pressure principle is good, but that is not the core, everything. Pressure principle is good in the early part of your life. When you come to the middle and to the old age, you find it is not going to work. And the perception, how do you perceive the world, more and more you become older, you understand how much your perception, your recognition, cognition changing towards different views to the different people and different material, so consciousness, perception also transient. And many of you are caught up with your own findings, caught up with your achievements, caught up with your productivity, caught up with your future projections, and they sometimes consider as me, myself and my soul. So each one of us has kind of advantageous point with respect to these four and some of the disadvantageous point. And the Buddha invite us to see the disadvantages of the materiality as it is nihilistic, exactly the same disadvantages if you are going to take the consciousness as myself, consciousness as me, consciousness as my. So therefore, we have to use the available raw material and put it in a comparative study, and then to take an object, to realize it, see it under your very nose. So therefore, it must be not only theoretical understanding and deductive knowledge and inferential thing. You have to have kind of a practical aspect also. That is to, through your concentrated mind, you have to see things as they are. Then only you can have a balanced understanding to go into that kind of a challenge, or we'll say a personal experimentation. The Buddha says the vijnana, that is the consciousness, is arising then and there according to its own course. And that very consciousness is labeled according to the course. Giving an example, he says, when and where the visual objects, the shapes and the colors, come and impinge or avenued to your sensitivity of the eye, there's a kind of a consciousness, we call this eye consciousness. When you the sound come and strikes on your eardrums, That's a kind of a consciousness arises. That's called ear consciousness. Whenever the smell, good or bad, come and strike on your nostrils, then there is a consciousness known as the nose consciousness. And when the food items, drinkables, come and contact with your taste buds, you get the tongue consciousness. Any tactile thing come and contact you, there's a body consciousness. So he says, besides these eye consciousness, ear consciousness, nose, tongue, body, and the last with the thinking with the mind, there's no something called just mere consciousness. Everything is labeled with particular causative aspect. That means, as far as the causes are changing, the consciousness is changing. And to give an example, the Buddha says, whenever there's a fire consuming a log, that fire is called log fire. Whenever the fire is consuming twigs and the parts, it is called the twig fire. Whenever it is consuming straw, it is called straw fire. When it is consuming chaff of particles, it's called chaff fire. And when it's consuming cow dung, India is very famous. It's called cow dung fire. Buddha is asking, is there any something called mere just fire without any kind of a fuel? No. Each and every fire has its own fuel. According to the fuel, not the fire is labeled. So there is no something called the mere fire. It's exactly the way there is no mere consciousness. But when and where you see something, or when and where you hear something, or smell something, taste, touch, or thinking, our consciousness hiding majority part of the scene, it never allow you to understand that now your whole concern is with your eye. Or your whole concern with your ear, or nose, or tongue, or body, or the mind. It gets so much of absorbed into, attracted into, you admire what you see, never recognize it is eye consciousness. If you have to understand this consciousness is coming through the eye or through your visual objects, you have to be very, very contemplative. With normal mindfulness is not enough. When and where you are listening something, you have to understand now consciousness is not the eye consciousness, but the ear consciousness. There will be so much of contemplative, because whatever you are going to listen, take yourself for a ride. No, not giving any chance you to recognize this now consciousness change from the eye to the ear, or to the nose, or to the tongue, or to the body, or to the mind. For example, when you are in a walking meditation, you're supposed to keep the consciousness in the body consciousness touching the curve. You keep the right leg and you see, feel the hardness, stiffness, tension. Lightness, effortlessness, or effortfulness, heaviness, whatever may be, you know the body consciousness, when the body, tactile sensation of the body or sensitivity of the body touch the ground. And it is changing from left leg to right leg, that is happening. So suppose that you are successful in keeping the attention with the left leg to the right leg, right to the left leg, while you are in the middle part of the middle area of the walking path. You can be, keep the track with the sensitivity of the body. But imagine when you go to the end, when you are turning, you see a bird. You see a beautiful butterfly. You see a beautiful flower. Then immediately the consciousness changes into the eye consciousness. The tactile sensation of your sensitivity of the body gives rise without any prior notice. Jumping into the eye and you see, and you must get so much of carried away by the what you have seen, you hardly you can notice that consciousness change from one cause to the other. So unless otherwise you are mindful, unless otherwise you go prepared, unless otherwise you have this theoretical knowledge, unless otherwise you present and discuss it and sort it out, you will be considering, I am so lucky to come to the Orlando and see that particular beautiful bird. You just forget about that you are a yogi. Just forget about that you are supposed to keep the attention with the leg. Instead, you admire the bird. You will be feel sorry, I don't have my camera with me to keep a good snap. And if it is the nanotechnology, still better, because movements are so precious. So much you taken away, and how much you have to develop the meditation to see how swiftly, without any prior notice, and without giving any chance, the consciousness changing from tactile sensation in the leg to the eye. And next time, immediately, you will be carried away by a sound, or a smell, or kind of a taste. Whatever may be, I am just citing example in the walking meditation in that sense, very colorful, very dramatic, very eventful, but you have to have very well versatile, develop mindfulness to see. So what the Buddha says is, when and where the causative factors are changing, accordingly the consciousness is being labeled, and consciousness is changing one to the other without tracing, without leaving any trace, without giving any sign. So it appears like continuity, that's a completely different picture. Completely different episode, that is what, that up to that much you must be smart. So you must be ready with the mindfulness to see when and where the shift happens, to note it or be aware of it. But I will give a clue, when and where you have to understand, I must keep my touch with the soul. When it is touching the ground, I am doing walking meditation. Instead, now what happens is I see a beautiful bird. So therefore, now my consciousness changed from the leg or bodily tactile sensation to the eye. When and where you develop then and there mindfulness, the beauty of the bird will be reduced. You can't entertain. That is the secret behind. If you have to entertain the bird, if you have to appreciate the bird, you have to be ignorant. You have to be unmindful. You have to be forgetful. Then only the obsession can happen. Then only the appreciation can happen. So if you are going with the pleasure principle, how much you have to be forgetful about your mechanism. Mechanism of the consciousness. So therefore, we are developing normal mindfulness, we don't assimilate, we don't project up to that much of subtlety, but you have to keep it in your mind, the simple mindfulness that you develop while in a sitting, in breathing, one day develop in the walking, ultimately going to give thin slicing of time, so that one day you will understand episode to episode, the mind, the consciousness changing the causative agent, accordingly the consciousness is changing. So then only you can understand how much you, without an agenda, you have no controlling power at all, nowhere. It is jumping from one to the other. Not only that, it keeps you so imbibed, so absorbed, so possessed, so obsessed. So ultimately be happy with your experience, undermining your mindfulness and the mechanism of the tricky consciousness. So therefore, we have to have preparedness, certain amount of mindfulness and theory understanding, and then the alertness, then only one day we can understand, and till that we are also equally the bhikkhusati. So that's a remark for the today's talk. With that, I am going to sum up the day's talk, and I like to continue tomorrow with the particular discourse as well as with our experiences, so that I think the the complicated subject will be little by little, will be absorbable and comprehensible. So I need your full attention, all in practice as well as theoretical understanding, so that we will try to sort out this complicated sum. Thank you very much for listening. When we are having a retreat in Sri Lanka, what we do is, after the Dhamma talk, we do kind of a, it's a ritualistic, or you can say a kind of a religious activity, the sharing of merits. And because that we will be meeting here, of course we will be continuing till 10 o'clock. So after the Dhamma talk, I would like to, with the topic of sharing of merits, to thankful for the, all the people and all the beings seen and unseen helped organize this retreat. And after the first day, we were successful. Without a hitch, we came. So whatever the merits, whatever the meritorial deeds we accumulate, we will share with the, all the seen and unseen beings. Help organize this retreat with 3 times sadhu, 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 sadhu. The next aspect is in our Theravada tradition, we always share our merit with our dear and near ones, relatives. So, whoever may be the relative living or deceased, wish to share this kind of merits, we must be generous. And we invite any such a being in a position to appreciate our merits. May they pay the attention for the moment to the place and time we are accumulating merits. And together with us, they may share merits with 3 times, sadhu, 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 sadhu. And the last, all these endeavorance will help us to understand this precious Dhamma in this very life. So we ourselves also get the due share. That also we will three times sadhu, 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 sadhu. In Sri Lanka what we do is we recite stanza, Pali stanza. So those who know may follow me, others may pay attention, listen with due attention. Ettavata ca gammehi sambhatam punya sampadam sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampatti siddhya. Ettavata ca gammehi sambhatam punya sampadam sabbe bhuta anumodantu sabba sampatti siddhya. Ettavata ca gammehi sambhatam punya sampadam sabbe satta anumodantu sabba sampatti siddhya. Akasattha ca bhummattha deva naga mahiddhika punyantam anumoditva chiram rakkantu sasana. Akasattha ca bhummattha deva naga mahiddhika punyantam anumoditva chiram rakkantu desana. ఆకాశట్టా చ బుమ్మట్టా దేవానాగా మహిద్దికా పుణ్యంతం అనుమోదిత్వా చిరం రక్షంతు మం పరం ఇదం వో జ్ఞాతీనాం హోతు సుఖితా హంతు జ్ఞాతయో ఇదం వో జ్ఞాతీనాం హోతు సుఖితా హంతు జ్ఞాతయో ఇదం వో జ్ఞాతీనాం హోతు సుఖితా హంతు జ్ఞాతయో ఇమినా పుణ్యకమ్మేనే మామీ బాల సమాగము శతం సమాగమో హోతు యావ నిపాన పత్యా. ఇమినా పుణ్యకమ్మేనే మామీ బాల సమాగము శతం సమాగమో హోతు యావ నిపాన పత్యా. ఇమినా పుణ్యకమ్మేనే మామీ బాల సమాగము శతం సమాగమో హోతు యావ నిబ్బాన పత్యా. సాధు సాధు సాధు.